Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels' family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Holly Fry.
And I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
Tracy, I don't know why I've never asked you this before. Mm-hmm. Do you watch What We Do in the Shadows?
I intend to watch What We Do in the Shadows. There's just too much. There's too much stuff to watch right now.
There is way too much. I won't shade anybody ever for not keeping up with something because who can? I'm scared of the person that keeps up with everything. But the opening credits of What We Do in the Shadows has a series of amazing spoofs of famous and not so famous pieces of art with the characters from the show painted into them as though they have been around for hundreds and hundreds of years because they are vampires. Almost every piece of art, we'll talk about some variations, is actually based on an existing piece of art. Art. It's such good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Two of those pieces are based on the work of Gustave Courbet. And I really have wanted to talk about him anyway, and that was a good entree because I love that show. It is just starting its fourth season, I think, as we publish this episode. It should be out already, and it's so fun. Obviously, not for all ages. It's a very grown-up show but with adult themes. Similarly, this episode, I will warn you, at one point we are going to talk about a painting that is pretty graphic and explicit. If you have younger art historians or art enthusiasts with you, you might want to preview it just for safety. I don't know how you feel about it. Everybody's got a different threshold. But Courbet was iconic, even in his own lifetime. He flew in the face of artistic convention. He turned down awards. He ushered in a new movement of realism in France. He was kind of like the bad boy of mid-19th century Paris art scene. And he also became embroiled in the country's political turmoil. So that is who we are talking about today.
Jean-Désiré Gustave Courbet was born on June 10th, 1819, in the small town of Ornon, France. This is in the east of France, not far from the border with Switzerland. His parents were Régis and Sylvie Udo Courbet. And Régis is sometimes described as a farmer, but to be clear, he was a very successful farmer. This wasn't like a small family farm. He wasn't doing farm work on somebody else's farm. He had a large-scale, multi-property commercial farm that included some really lucrative vineyards. Gustav also had three younger sisters, Zoe, Zélie, and Juliette. And these daughters appeared in a lot of their brother's paintings.
Yeah, he liked to paint his friends and family in paintings, as well as himself, which we'll talk about. After his early schooling, Gustav enrolled at the Collège Royal and then attended a fine art school in Besançon. His proclivity toward becoming an artist wasn't really in line with what his parents had in mind for him. They wanted him to pursue a career in law. So when he was in his early 20s, the actual year this happened varies by source, but they sent him to Paris to study law. He did not do that. he is said to have been really very, very close to this family and to have truly loved his parents. We'll talk a lot about his letters home to his parents and his family, but he really just did not see any path for himself in life but art.
So when he got to Paris, he did not enroll in law school. It's unsurprising based on what Holly just said. But he also didn't enroll in art school, though. He went to the Louvre and studied the art there and also made contact with artists who lived in the city so he could take private lessons, in some cases ask them for advice. In particular, he studied with Romantic painter Baron Charles von Steuben and finally confessed all of this to his father. He said he could not be a lawyer. He only wanted to be an artist. His father's response was surprising and incredibly supportive. He wrote to his son, quote, "If anyone gives up, it will be you, not me." He assured his son that he would support his ambitions, both emotionally and financially, and that he would sell off everything he had if it came to that. I don't think that's what he was expecting of his father.
So Courbet, with his father's blessing at this point, started pursuing an art career in earnest. He wrote to his parents, quote, "Within 5 years, I must have a reputation in Paris." But he still did not enroll at any formal school. Instead, he was largely self-taught, and his development was based largely on copying works of famous artists, something a lot of artists did and still do to gain technical skills and form their own style. He also, as we said, took some private lessons. And he started submitting his original works to the Académie des Beaux-Arts annual Salon exhibit. And in 1844, just a few years into this effort, one of his paintings was accepted.
That painting was Courbet with a Black Dog, or Self-Portrait with a Black Dog. This is not a close-up portrait, but a full view of the subject. That, of course, is Courbet himself, obviously. He's seated with his entire body included. And it's interesting because Courbet appears to be sitting on the ground with an English spaniel standing partially on his lap. But the point of view of the viewer is even lower down than the subject, close to the ground. So Courbet appears to be looking down. He has on a hat that has his upper face in shadow and a drapey coat that's flipped open at his leg to reveal a yellow lining. Courbet wrote to his family of the acceptance of this painting, saying, quote, "I have been admitted to the exhibition and am highly delighted. It is not the picture I should have preferred them to take, but it makes no matter. They did me the honor of hanging me well in the exhibition, and that is some compensation."
The following year, 1845, Courbet, spurred on by his success, submitted 5 works for consideration for the Salon, but only one small one was accepted. That's Le Guitarero, and it features a man in an almost reverse image of the black dog portrait from the previous year we just described. Once again, seated on the ground, but this time, no dog in his lap, he's cradling a guitar. This is a very romantic image, hearkening to an earlier time period, and although it's not categorized as a self-portrait, Courbet pretty obviously used himself as a model. Courbet continued to submit pieces for the Salon in the years after this, but his success rate kind of dropped off and was pretty low. But he remained undaunted. He was a very confident person. That's probably a little easier when you know you have financial backing. And he continued to paint, and he continued to envision and plan his place in the art world.
Even in these early years of his career, Gustav was really shrewd about crafting his image with the public and with the art community. Though he had come from a wealthy family and he received a good education, because he came from the country, Parisians often assumed he was just an uneducated peasant. He was totally happy to let people do that because he knew it added to his mystique as a painter.
He saw every opportunity to like build his life story in a way that would increase interest in his work. We'll talk about one later on that is a little mind-blowing to me. One of the paintings that Courbet worked on starting in the 1840s was one called The Wounded Man. This was another image of the artist himself, this time in the romantic role of a man reclining with his eyes closed, having suffered an injury, presumably from a sword. This is a painting that is often listed as having started in the 1840s and being finished in the 1850s. He didn't normally take that long to make a painting, but it wasn't considered finished until then because Courbet altered it significantly at one point. The hero in the image had been accompanied by a woman leaning over his shoulder. She was, it is believed, based on Virginie Binet, who modeled for a lot of paintings for Courbet during a roughly 10-year-long romantic relationship. The two of them were not married, but they lived together as a couple. To all outward appearances, they were as committed as a married couple. They had a son together named Désiré Alfred Émile. But in the early 1950s, Virginie moved away from Paris when she and Courbet broke up, and she took their child with her. And it seems that she and Courbet had no contact after the breakup. And Courbet had then painted her out of the wounded man, and he placed a sword in her place in the painting. If you look at it, it does look a little weird. It's not bad. It's just a strange. It doesn't feel like that was part of the original composition. He did not, after this, have any long-term serious relationships, although there were a lot of women in his life. He kind of just enjoyed playing the field, it seems. He wrote to a friend of his relationships with women, quote, "I am as inclined to get married as I am to hang myself."
Courbet's relationship with the Salon waxed and waned in the late 1840s. He went from that elation of having felt that his work was well-placed and that he was just getting started. He went from that to a long series of setbacks and feeling as though he would never again gain recognition. 1847 was especially rough for him. He submitted 3 paintings and all 3 were rejected.
So we've been talking about the Salon and submitting every year. And if you're wondering, why didn't he just show his art somewhere else? There really wasn't another avenue available at this time in Paris. The Salon was the art show of the year, and it was the place where patrons went to purchase art and develop relationships with artists so they would have ongoing patronages in some place. Courbet had written of it to his family, quote, "I must exhibit to make myself known, and unfortunately, that is the only exhibition. In past years, when I had not thoroughly mastered my own style and was still painting to a certain extent in theirs, they accepted my work. But now that I am myself, there is no hope for me." Other now famous artists were similarly despondent at the way the Salon jury was running things. Several had even met to brainstorm how they might establish a new independent Salon, and that included people like Delacroix and Rousseau.
In 1848, King Louis-Philippe of France was forced to abdicate, and later that year, Louis-Napoleon Bonaparte became the first president of the Second French Republic. Of course, this was a huge change for the country, but for Gustave Courbet and other artists, it resulted in a very significant shift in how the Salon was juried and had less rigid requirements for subject matter and style. At the 1848 exhibition, he had 10 paintings accepted for showing. A lot of his paintings during this time reflected the change in France's shifting socio-political climate. At a time when voting rights were expanding, for men anyway, and the right to work was also adopted as a governmental reform, Courbet was painting people at work in various trades. He also had the very unique insight, or possibly conceit, to see that he was the face of a huge change in art. He wrote to his family, quote, "I'm about to make it any time now, for I am surrounded by people who are very influential in the newspapers and the arts, and who are very excited about my painting. Indeed, we are about to form a new school of which I will be the representative in the field of painting."
In a moment, we will talk about Gustave Courbet's shift to painting landscapes and pastorals and how his representation of the common man became so important in art history. But first, we will pause for a sponsor break.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper, waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. At this point, Courbet had been in Paris for roughly a decade trying to make a name for himself. He had shifted from those romantic portraits we talked about to doing some more different types of art. And although he had his father's financial support and then the support of an art collector benefactor named Alfred Bruyat, no one could argue that he had been idle during those 10 years. He had finally earned a gold medal in the Paris Salon, and that meant that he didn't have to submit his work to salon juries for exhibition going forward. So he took a little pause and he went home to Ornon to spend time with his family. And this break from life in the city really proved to be exactly what the artist needed. And being back in the countryside inspired Courbet in a whole new way.
Two of Courbet's most famous paintings were inspired by this visit home. The first was titled Les Casseurs de Pierre, or The Stonebreakers.
As its title suggests, this is an image of an older man breaking stones and a younger man carrying a basket of broken pieces along the side of the road. There's an empty, dark landscape behind them. This is an interesting image because not only did it come to be seen as a clear example of Courbet's desire to put realism front and center, it also shows everyday working people in vivid detail without romanticizing their lives. It was eventually recognized as raising questions about France's socioeconomic structure.
And that last bit is especially interesting because while most art historians today would credit Courbet with being very deliberate about making a social statement, and Courbet himself later claimed that that was all intentional, there have definitely been some write-ups about this work that suggest that it might have been a little bit less calculated. Courbet had seen a man named Gagy, who was a road mender, working as the artist passed by him in a carriage, and he had written to a friend about it. Quote, "Here is an old man of 70, bending over his work with his hammer raised, his body burned by the sun, his face shaded with a wide straw hat, his coarse, stiff breeches are all patched, and his heels are showing through his stockings, which once were white, in his broken old wooden shoes. Near him is a young man, his skin burned brown, his filthy ragged shirt shows his side and his arms. Alas, in such low life, this is the beginning and the end. Rarely can one find so complete an expression of poverty and wretchedness." Courbet then invited Gagy to his studio to sit for him for the painting of the Stonebreakers.
The second famous work that was inspired by that trip to Ornans was A Burial at Ornans, which he painted in 1850. This painting is massive, 315 centimeters by 660 centimeters, or 21 feet by 10 feet. It depicts his great uncle's funeral. There are more than 40 people in this composition, which is very dark. It includes mourners, clergy, and family. They're all gathered around an open grave. He showed this at the 1851 Salon, much to the chagrin of critics. The large dimensions that Courbet had used were normally reserved for romantic subjects. So seeing such a stark scene realistically painted on something so big, that was considered gauche and in poor taste. Even so, some critics understood the importance of this as a moment of massive change in art. One write-up said that Courbet had established himself as an artist, quote, "in the manner of a cannonball which lodges itself in a wall."
That's such a great description. These two pieces look so classic as pieces of art to modern eyes, not to be confused with classicism. But they just look like, when you look at them, you're like, yes, that seems like famous old art. It can be difficult, though, to grasp just how radical they were considered in mid-19th century France. At a time when the art world was very much about showing the beauty of all things. And indeed, we said Courbet had studied with a romantic painter, but he had shifted gears and he was painting things that most people at the time would not consider beautiful. And he was doing it with this very intense detail and what is often described as urgency.
These pastorals cemented him in the eyes of the art and literature scene of France as the major player in the new realism movement. So we should level set for just a moment and talk about realism and what it means, because it's easy to assume it means one thing when really it's a pretty broad term. Realism in terms of art is not necessarily about replicating a real world object in faithful accuracy, although it can include that. The more important foundation of it is depicting real things rather than something fanciful or imagined. There are a lot of works of art that can be put under this umbrella, going all the way back to ancient Greek sculpture, but the term realism didn't really come into play as an artistic school of thought until the 19th century when Courbet was alive.
And the realism movement that Courbet is associated with was a rejection of the classicism and romanticism that had been the standard for French art for a very long time. He wrote about this in a letter in 1861 in a way that makes his feelings on this matter entirely clear, writing, quote, "Painting is an essentially concrete art and can consist only of the representation of things both real and existing."
As he came to recognize that his work depicting the French countryside had given him a reputation and deeper name recognition, Courbet really leaned into it. Ornon, where he was born, is in the province of Bourgogne-Franche-Comte, which is in the eastern part of France, and it became the star of a lot of Courbet's work.
When Louis Napoleon declared himself Emperor Napoleon III after staging a coup, the atmosphere for art in Paris once again shifted. Although Gustave Courbet had already been seen as controversial in his work, as the government became more authoritarian and a lot more conservative in its taste, his work was perceived as being downright confrontational. His painting, Young Ladies of the Village, which shows three women, modeled by his sisters, offering alms to a young girl who is herding cows, was critiqued as a clumsy affront to social mores. When you look at this painting today, you go, oh, that's lovely. But people were real mad about it at the time.
In 1854, Gustave started to work on a massive project, and we use massive both literally and figuratively. The canvas of the painting, which he completed in 6 weeks, is 361 by 598 centimeters. That's 11.8 feet by 19.6 feet, so similar to the dimensions of a burial at Ornon. But the subject matter is expansive as well. The painting is sometimes called the artist's studio or the painter's studio, but the full title is A Painter's Studio, a real allegory summing up 7 years of my life as an artist. Courbet is at the center of the painting, working. He's painting a landscape of an area near Ornon. Behind him is what appears to be an artist's model. It's a naked woman with her dress at her feet, but he's not painting her or even looking at her. Instead, she is closely watching him. There's also a small child watching him paint. So these three figures, Courbet, the woman, and the child, form the central grouping of the image, and the rest of the painting's casts of characters are separated to the right and the left.
The group to the left is filled with the sort of rural characters that populated much of Courbet's work. There's also a representation of the crucifixion of Christ on the left side as well, close to and kind of just behind the left side of the painter's canvas in the image as he works. On the right are Courbet's friends and patrons, including the writer Charles Baudelaire. This painting continues to be interpreted and analyzed by art history scholars. In mixing allegory and reality, Courbet seems to have laid out a puzzle for the viewer to solve, but no one seems to agree on what exactly the meaning of the piece is.
This painting was submitted for the 1855 exhibition in Paris, and it was not accepted. After having achieved a level of recognition where he had been able to place pieces in the Salon without jury approval, this was just a slap in the face. Napoleon III had directed that only pleasant art be included at the Salon, and the artist's studio was determined to be too demanding of the viewer. And Courbet had 11 pieces accepted for the Salon, but he just took matters into his own hands to get all of his paintings in front of the eyes of the public. He rented a space near the exposition and set up his own pavilion to showcase this huge painting as well as some other works. He called this the Pavilion of Realism. The Pavilion of Realism was not a success, although many of his contemporaries and Eugène Delacroix in particular admired the ambition of this effort. It just wasn't well attended. The public mostly saw this as a stunt or like a really expensive tantrum.
Yeah, there's one exchange. I will get it wrong because I'm just retelling it. I didn't quote it here. Where there was a person who was like, this is really a lot. Like, you really think highly of yourself. And Courbet wrote back, do you not know I'm the most arrogant person in Paris? He was just like, it's just like, this is how it is, dude. It's all my paintings or nothing. Incidentally, it was during the 1850s when Courbet's fame was rapidly on the rise that he painted the two paintings that are spoofed in the opening of What We Do in the Shadows. The first, in terms of when Courbet painted it, although I think it appears second in the opening credits of the show, is a painting titled Madame Auguste Cuoq, which was a commissioned rendering of Mathilde Desportes as ordered by her husband. This features a woman in almost full length, wearing a black pleated gown with a striking green wrap. The television show created one with the vampire Nadia as Madame Desportes. And in the show's opening, there is also a matching painting of Nadia's husband, Laszlo, although Courbet did not paint a companion piece to Madame Auguste Quoc. The second Courbet spoof in the TV show's opening credits once again features Nadia in a recreation of Courbet's 1856 painting, Woman in a Riding Hat. You'll also see that sometimes listed as the Horsewoman. This was also a portrait commission. Gustave was hired to paint Madame Clément Laurier as a wedding gift to the bride from her husband. In this case, Courbet did also paint a portrait of Monsieur Laurier, but it is not that portrait that's used for Laszlo in the show. There's a matching portrait made that appears to be an original creation to look more like a match to the Madame Laurier painting. You can see both of Courbet's original portraits at the Met if you're interested and want to do a some sort of What We Do in the Shadows art crawl. That sounds great.
In a moment, we'll talk about Courbet's influence on the Impressionists who followed him and his involvement in politics. But first, we are going to hear from some of the sponsors who keep Stuff You Missed in History Class going. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper, waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Say goodbye to complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping, and say hello to an advantage with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Every business faces challenges, but shipping shouldn't be one of them. So keep things simple with clear, upfront pricing. And no unexpected surcharges for Saturday deliveries, residential deliveries, or fuel. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there, helping you counter the rising costs of doing business with a budget-friendly alternative. And keep things reliable with on-time ground shipping, ensuring your shipments get to where they need to go while maintaining your hard-earned reputation. USPS Ground Advantage is your ticket to easy, cost-effective, and dependable shipping. It's the complete delivery service your business needs to rise above the competition. There's never been a better time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There is still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more, while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Went to Germany for a visit in 1856, and there he made a lot of new connections with fellow artists. Whereas France had come to see Courbet at this point as a rabble-rouser or sometimes even a nuisance for the way that he both ignored the traditions of the art scene of the day and thumbed his nose at criticism, it seems that the German sensibilities were more willing to embrace his realism. He had painted a lot of works that featured hunting parties, and those were particularly popular in Germany.
One of the interesting aspects of Courbet's realism is that it wasn't confined to any particular subject matter. He painted landscapes. He painted the lower classes at their work. He made portraits of himself and other people. He painted nude studies of women, quite a lot of them.
His work in landscapes, though, is often said to have paved the way for the Impressionist movement. As he worked to capture things like the sky as it was breaking into a storm over the sea at the shoreline, he had started to bring in the ideas that shaped Impressionism, particularly in his use of color and light reflections. Whereas Courbet's realism was all about capturing all and any subjects of the world, Impressionism would kind of take that to a new space as it showed the world realistically, but with a focus on the ways that light and color can shift our perceptions of reality.
Throughout the 1860s, Gustave enjoyed quite a bit of success. He had become the figurehead not just for realism, but for breaking away from the establishment. And that really rebellious spirit combined with his skill attracted a lot of collectors. And though his relationship with the French government under Napoleon III wasn't good, he was nominated as a recipient of the French Legion of Honor in 1870. Courbet turned this down, writing, quote, "Honor does not lie in a title or a ribbon. It lies in actions and the motives for actions. I honor myself by remaining faithful to my lifelong principles. If I betrayed them, I should desert honor to wear its mark."
Yeah, he was not a fan of Napoleon III's government. At the end of the Franco-German War, also called the Franco-Prussian War, the Paris Commune formed as an insurrectionist group in response to dissatisfaction at the armistice agreement that France had signed with Germany. Emperor Napoleon III had entered the war way overconfident, and France had not really been prepared. And in the Treaty of Frankfurt, France had had to concede the annexation of Alsace and part of Lorraine, as well as the payment of 5 billion francs to cover the expenses of the German army's occupation of France. In the briefest of terms, this meant that the Paris Commune was against both the army of Versailles and the German army. There was fear that the National Assembly was going to reinstate the monarchy, which was opposite of what Parisians who favored the Republic wanted, and Courbet aligned with the Commune as it attempted to establish its own French government and reject the Third Republic and Napoleon III. The Commune had been established in the middle of March 1871, and it was suppressed in May, so it didn't last very long. And Courbet had left the group early in May before it was disbanded, because he actually found it too extreme. So we'll hear in a quote later, he didn't really like aligning with anybody. But that association with the Paris Commune really hurt him.
Courbet had been elected president of the Artists' Federation, and in that role, it fell to him to re-establish the National Salon and to reopen the museums, which had been closed during the war. He made an unusual move, though, and instead focused on monuments outside of Paris. The palace at Fontainebleau, which had been occupied by German forces, and the porcelain factory at Sèvres.
As all of this was going on,
members of the Paris Commune had decided to destroy a military monument in the Place Vendôme. It was a column that commemorated Napoleon Bonaparte's military, and it was something Courbet had spoken of with disdain on many occasions. When the Commune destroyed it on May 16th, Courbet was believed to have spearheaded the move, even though he had left the group before that happened. He had circulated a petition to take that monument down the year before in 1870, so there was an official record of him calling for its destruction. After the Commune was conclusively defeated by the Army of Versailles at the end of May, Courbet was arrested in the first week of June and put on trial as a political instigator.
This trial did not go well. The people who actually had destroyed the monument had fled the country, although they had insisted that the artist had not been involved. Even so, he was found guilty and sentenced to 6 months in prison. There was also a fine, although because Courbet had friends who were highly placed in the new provisional government, the sum of that fine was minimal.
Yeah, he was in this unique space where he kind of disliked every established thing and fought against it. But he also had friends in almost every position, you know, with any alignment, because a lot of people were buying his work and were fans of his. Gustave Courbet was sent to prison at Saint-Pélagie, but he fell ill and he was transferred to a medical facility near Paris to finish his sentence. When that sentence ended and he was a free man again, he did not stay in Paris. He instead went back to his beloved countryside and family in Ornon. He hoped to rest and rebuild his health and put the whole thing behind him. But that was not to be. But even while incarcerated, he had written letters to his family that this whole ordeal had a bright side, which is it was only going to drive up interest in his work and enable him to raise his prices.
In 1872, Adolphe Thiers, who had helped ensure Courbet's fines weren't too steep after his trial, resigned from his presidency. This put Bonaparte loyalists back in power. They did not feel that Courbet had truly paid his debt to society, so the French government sued Courbet for the money needed to replace the destroyed monument. The trial for this was never going to go his way. Courbet was fined 500,000 francs, and this was an absurd amount of money. There was no way he could pay it. By the time the judgment was passed down, all of Courbet's assets had already been seized, including all of his paintings. Everything he owned had been taken by the French government.
Yeah, I have seen different numbers aside from that 500,000 francs, but it's always many hundreds of thousand francs. It's kind of like the absurdly high number of going, Tracy, you owe me $12 billion. No, really, it was $13 billion. I mean, it's like it felt that absurd to him because he had nothing. In addition to that, the government had been watching his family and friends. They were all under surveillance. And a number of artists that he was associated with finally decided that being associated with him was too dangerous and that he needed to be barred from future salons and basically excommunicated from the city's art circles. One of his friends in the art world wrote to another the sad phrase, "He must be dead to us." So he left the country and headed for Switzerland. On July 23, 1873, he left France and never returned.
Initially, Courbet went to Fleurières, which is only about 10 kilometers or a little more than 6 miles away from the French border. But Gustave became anxious that this was just too close to France, so he moved about 85 kilometers south to Levet-en-Lac-Leman. He didn't stay there either, but also didn't travel very far before putting down roots. He went just about 2 kilometers more south to La Tour de Piles and purchased an inn, which he named Bon Port, or Safe Harbor.
Because he had left Paris, he actually missed out on a move by some of his fellow artists, which no doubt would have pleased him. In 1874, Monet, Pizarro, Cézanne, and Renoir, tired of the Paris Salon offering the only chance at having their work publicly seen, put together their own show. And that is actually the art exhibition that the term Impressionist was coined at. Many art historians credit Courbet's daring with helping to kickstart the Impressionists. Some have said it would have happened anyway, but it happened about 10 years earlier than it would have had Courbet not been involved.
In his final years, Courbet drank heavily and neglected his health. The stress of the trials and his incarceration and having so many of his colleagues turn their back on him, that all took a toll.
He had hoped that he might be granted an amnesty and be able to return to France, but instead the French government directed him to pay the cost of the monument in 10,000 franc installments.
It's like going, you'll owe us forever. They also auctioned off all of his art that they had seized. Courbet died on December 31st, 1877. He was only 58, and the cause of his death was listed as edema. That was likely the result of drinking. Although he had never gotten to return to France in life, in 1919, his remains were moved from Switzerland to Ornon, where he was reinterred in the same cemetery featured in his painting, A Burial at Ornon.
A 1912 collection of Courbet's work with commentary by Léonce Bénédict opens with the line, quote, Courbet was one of Courbet's favorite subjects. It has often been thrown up against him by men who forget that an artist has great difficulty in finding a model as convenient or as well-studied as himself. But, it was said, the painter who delighted in making so many of his contemporaries look uglier than they were was much nicer and more generous when it came to his own face. The artist has no excuse save the masterpieces that his rather exclusive indulgence has given us. We've only talked about a couple of the self-portraits here. It's worth checking out more of them. The one that's going to be on our social media is not one of the ones that we have mentioned here, but is striking.
But really, Gustave Courbet gave the art world an awful lot more than beautiful paintings. His rebellious spirit, which was part of his art really before he even became politically active, led to a number of innovations and moves that scandalized the art world at the time, but became very commonplace as later generations of artists adopted them. We already talked about his embrace of realism at a time when Romanticism was the standard. His provocative paintings and behaviors were not accidental. He had written early in his career that he had a goal, quote, to change the public's taste and way of seeing. No small task, for it means no more and no less than overturning what exists and replacing it.
In addition to that, Courbet's nudes threw the Paris art establishment into a tizzy. He was certainly not at all the first person to paint nude figures. Historical figures in art were completely acceptable at the time as nudes, even in very sensual scenarios. But his realism was very real. It left nothing to the imagination. It wasn't romanticized. One of his most well-known examples of this is a painting titled Origin of the World, or L'Origine du Monde, which is a view of a woman's body lying on a bed in which her genitalia are the focus of the work. When he painted this in 1866, it was completely shocking. It was a private commission, and it didn't go on public display, but art critics certainly saw it, and they weighed in on it. There's debate around it that continues until this day. The Origin of the World passed from private collector to private collector over the years. It was once even owned by Jacques Lacan, but it didn't go on public display until 1988, when it was shown at the Brooklyn Museum in New York. Today, it's part of the collection of the Musée d'Orsay, and it still elicits really strong responses, but it and similar work set the stage for other artists to show human bodies without the limitations that the art established had placed on them before this work. There's also some fun gossip about who the model for this may have been that Holly's going to talk about on Friday.
Yes, that gossip is good. This is interesting because it's one of those things that was considered pornographic when he painted it in 1866. There are still people today who will say that's straight up pornography and not art. It's very controversial, so he sure did stay relevant in that regard. Even in less explicit paintings, Courbet's detractors found him to be scandalous. In 1872, at a time when the painter's life and country were in upheaval, he painted a work called Sleep. And this features two naked women asleep in each other's arms. It was considered so controversial when it was shown publicly that there was actually a police report filed about it for indecency. As Courbet was already on the outs with the French government at this time, that report went into a file that was being kept to document his life.
On a more technical note, rather than relating to his subject matter, Courbet was also one of the first artists to use a palette knife in his fingers to apply the paint to the canvas. Palette knives were strictly considered mixing tools at the time. So this was the fine art equivalent of applying wall paint with a stir stick. For Courbet, though, it was a different way to control his medium.
Yeah, and it was one of those things. I mean, obviously it worked and he was very good at it. I think it was Cézanne that said like his talent was just limitless. And it was kind of a reflection of him being able to do completely new things in ways that resulted in just beautiful work. Today, Courbet's work is recognized for its importance in the development of Western art. There are frequent exhibitions mounted featuring most of his works. Two canvases, though, are generally excluded. Both Burial at Ornon and the Painter's Studio are very large, which makes shipping difficult, but they are also considered to be too delicate to be shipped. So even though they are considered some of his most important works, both remain in the permanent collection of the Musée d'Orsay, and they cannot be loaned out. Another important Courbet painting that you will not see in any collected exhibit today is the Stonebreakers, because it was unfortunately destroyed during the bombing of Dresden in World War II.
8 years before his death, Courbet was embroiled in France's very volatile political shifts. He described himself and his ideology in a single succinct passage in a letter to a friend. It seems the right place to wrap up his story. He wrote, quote, "I am 50 years old, and I have always lived in freedom. Let me end my life free. When I am dead, let this be said of me. He belonged to no school, to no church, to no institution, to no academy, least of all to any regime except the regime of liberty."
Gustave Courbet. He's an interesting one. I have an interesting listener mail.
Cool.
Because, as I mentioned before, I'm still working through a whole lot of boxes that got sent to my house from the office. Many of our listeners have sent us gifts over the last couple of years, which I'm still opening. So I wanted to read this one and say a huge thank you to our listener, Greg, who writes, "Dear History Ladies, I was recently catching up on a significant backlog of podcasts and came across the one you did on Guatemala and how the United Fruit Company used to muck about in the politics of countries where they had interests. Please find enclosed a model United Fruit ship SS Talamanca, along with some other United Fruit items." Yes, that's right. I'm pulling it out of the box carefully.
I'm like, are you so about to show this to me? I'm so excited.
Show Tracy on camera. We got a model
what?
Ship.
Wow.
Dun, 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 dun. It's quite cool. Greg goes on, "I build model ships and integrate ephemera specific to the history of the ship into the model's display case. See included picture. I did not make the United Fruit Company model, but I found it in an antique shop and then accumulated the related items from other sources, thinking that I would incorporate them all into a single display and resell it. However, I've got too many models and too little time left, so when I revisited the Talamanca project after hearing your podcast, you folks came to mind. I believe they used to sell these models as a souvenir of your voyage, so it's quite likely this was once on the Talamanca. This particular example was in a very nasty state when I acquired it. You would not know it. It is pristine now. The deck has been cleaned and repainted, but years of neglect took their toll. The inside of the cargo hatch on the stern, which I didn't clean and repaint, represents what the entire deck looked like. I think the 4th of July menu is particularly interesting and evokes all kinds of images of what it must have been like to travel during this era." He included a menu, obviously. "I've got no idea what the story behind the button would be. If you've already got any of this stuff, I certainly do not. It's cool," Greg writes. "Feel free to re-gift or you can just toss it all. It doesn't really have much value. It was much more fun to send it to you rather than sell it in a yard sale. Take care, stay safe, and keep up the great work, Greg." Greg, thank you so much. This really is beautiful and it's super cool. And I am in the midst of doing a big house reorg, so I will 100% find a cool place for it. And then if Tracy wants it at some point, we'll hand it off and we'll just trade it back and forth for the rest of our lives.
Nice.
It was one of those boxes that I was like, oh, so many of the boxes shipped to me were books, and they're obviously like, when you pick up a box of books, you know that's what it is. And I picked that box up and went, this is not books, and then opened it and was delighted by the giant surprise inside. It was pretty
Yay.
Wonderful. If you would like to write to us, we're changing offices, so right now email is the way to go.
Yeah.
You can do that at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. You can also find us on social media as Missed in History. And we are, of course, easy to subscribe to. You can do that on the iHeartRadio app or anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts.
Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
As important as choosing the right destination when traveling is choosing the right travel partner.
Gene!
Eugene Fodor!
Gene, was good.
But be careful, because the worst trips result when two partners have two different agendas.
The CIA really need your help, Gene.
Freeze, Americano! Huh? Oh!
Gene, run!
Listen to Fodor's Guide to Espionage on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you want to level up your marketing and business knowledge, look no further than the Marketing School podcast, hosted by Neil Patel and yours truly, Eric Su. It is the number one marketing podcast on Apple and number 15 on business in the United States. Now, if you want to listen to interesting conversations with operators that have been there, done that, also with other interesting guests, then listen to Marketing School every weekday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi there, I'm Bob Pittman, Chairman and CEO of iHeartMedia. I'm excited to announce a new season of my podcast, Math and Magic, Stories from the Frontiers of Marketing. Our guests this season show us big risk can yield big rewards. Like Rob Reilly, the creative head of one of the world's leading advertising firms.
I try to create environments where anybody can say anything without any judgment.
Listen to a brand new season of Math and Magic on our very own iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcast.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.